This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There's no denying state spending and budgets are stretched tight. That's forcing a fresh look at the soaring cost of our prisons. What are we really getting for the $2 billion we spend each year on corrections? And how can we trim that bill? A nonpartisan nonprofit group called the Citizens Alliance for Prisons and Public Spending is offering some strategies to cut our prison population by 10,000 inmates without, they say, impacting public safety. Barbara Levine is with the group with CAPS. Barbara, you've prepared a strategy to cut the population of our prisons by 10,000. How much could that save us?
$250 million, $250 million a year once these strategies took full effect in, we estimate, 5 years.
Well, before we get into the strategies, let's look a little about what has caused the population and our expenses to balloon. When did this all kind of begin? Because when we think about 1973, we had fewer than 7,900 inmates in Michigan's prisons. What do we have, over 43,000 now?
Right, and it actually was as high as 51,500. It peaked in 2006 and has actually come down significantly since then. Unfortunately, the costs don't come down, but the population size has some, and we think we could safely do it at least another 10,000. What's caused it is the sort of what people call the get-tough strategies of policies of particularly the very late 70s, the 80s, and into the 90s, when the attitude was to keep people locked up for as long as possible. And sentences got longer, parole policies got tougher. In 1998, the state adopted Michigan's version of truth in sentencing that eliminated any amount of good time credit for prisoner good conduct or program participation. So there were lots of different steps taken that all added up to make Michigan's average prisoner length of stay, the amount of time prisoners serve in the state, substantially longer than the national average.
So we're keeping them in a lot longer. When we think corrections used to take up about 1.6% of general fund spending, and today it's nearly 20%. And we've all heard loudly and often by advocates of education that we spend $2 billion a year on corrections and we spend about $1.4 billion on higher education.
Yep. You can look at a line graph and see when the lines crossed. It used to be the opposite. It used to be we spent more on higher ed, and then it shifted and started in the other direction.
I'm speaking with Barbara Levine of Citizens Alliance for Prisons and Public Spending. They're offering strategies for reining in our corrections spending by shrinking Michigan's prison population. So let's talk about the areas where you've grouped your recommendations. Certainly, you know, you've got to reduce the number of people going in. That's a place to start. How would you suggest doing that?
You can adjust. Our sentencing guidelines were implemented in 1998, and then the commission that developed them and was supposed to oversee them and monitor their effectiveness was first defunded and then eliminated. And now the governor has just established a new Criminal Justice Policy Commission to look at our sentencing guidelines and also to look at parole and everything that actually impacts length of stay. For the sake of full disclosure, I'm one of the appointees to that commission, which has just begun its work. But one of the things that can be looked at is adjusting the sentencing guidelines to keep more people in community-based programs rather than going into prisons. You can have more intensive supervision of high-risk probationers than we currently have.
And I would suspect that's cheaper than keeping them in prison.
Oh, absolutely. Drug courts have been very successful. We can increase the use of drug courts, sobriety courts, mental health courts, veterans courts, things that address the causes of people's behavior, more participation and more availability of substance abuse and mental health treatment. As I'm sure you're aware, corrections and county jails have become the biggest provider of mental health services in this state, because when they expanded the prisons and shut down state mental health hospitals, the money didn't follow the mentally ill into the community. So now what you have is people who are mentally ill getting into trouble in the community and ending up in prison. 20% of the prison population is mentally ill, and I think the figures are even higher at the local jail. Things like changing the age of criminal responsibility so that 17-year-olds aren't being sent to prison. Michigan is one of only 9 states where the age of criminal responsibility is under 18. It's things that affect intake, and then for those people who do go to prison, it's things that affect the length of stay. Again, adjustments to sentencing guidelines can reduce the length of some sentences. We can adjust the way we treat habitual offenders. Right now, people's prior record can be counted in multiple ways, so their sentences just get longer and then longer again and then longer again. And then at the back end, there are various steps that could be taken to increase the rate of paroles for people who have served their minimum sentences.
You talk about in your report establishing presumptive parole. What is that?
Presumptive parole is a concept that we've been advocating for a long time, and I'm very happy to say there's actually a bill that got out of the House Criminal Justice Committee that would enact a presumption that when somebody who scores high probability of release on the Department of Corrections' own parole guidelines, that is, they fall into a low risk of reoffending category, that those people would actually get paroled when they've served their minimum sentence. We're not talking about an early release, but they would get paroled when they serve their minimum unless some very specific exceptions were met. Right now, there's about 1,900 prisoners who score high probability on those parole guidelines who have been denied release. And in hundreds of cases, the reasons given are very subjective. They're like insufficient remorse, lacks adequate insight. But what you can see when you start digging into statistics is that by far the largest number of those people committed a homicide offense, another sort of assault of offense, or a sex offense, and the board is reacting to the crime. Well, the crime was already taken into account in the length of sentence in the first place, and it really isn't the board's role to resentence people because they don't think the sentence was long enough. So unless there's evidence that somebody is currently a risk to public safety, and people who committed serious offenses years or even decades ago are not necessarily a risk today. In fact, they're likely not a risk today. And people who committed homicide and sex offenses actually have the lowest risk of reoffending of any of the offense groups. So the goal is to establish a presumption in statute that would make clear the expectation that people who have served their minimum and they've done their time well, they don't have a history of serious institutional misconduct, they don't have any charges pending, there's no evidence that they would be a risk to somebody today, those people should get out when they've done their time.
Now, you referenced, Barbara Levine, the State House having the Criminal Justice Committee having passed out the parole reform bill that would make it easier for some inmates to get out of prison. And we know that a similar bill got some real pushback a year ago from law enforcement groups and State Attorney General Schuette saying they could threaten public safety. How can you promise these suggested reforms could be done without risking public safety?
Because you look at the data, you look at the actual evidence, you see that the reoffense rates, as I said, for homicide and sex offenders are the lowest of any offense group. You look at the fact that you're keeping people far longer than in other states, and there's no evidence that Michigan is safer than other places. There's no evidence, and there's been a lot of academic research on it. There's simply no evidence that there's a relationship between how long you keep people and their likelihood of reoffending. We've got people walking the prison halls using walkers, being pushed in wheelchairs. What we're finding out is that this whole attitude in the 80s and the 90s that you couldn't sentence people harshly enough is resulting in taxpayers paying for people in their 60s, their 70s, their 80s, long, long past the time when they present any risk or could present a risk if they wanted to. We're paying for people who are developmentally disabled, who are suffering from dementia, who have terminal illnesses. We have to stop and think who we're locking up and why, and look at their actual risk as opposed to the rhetoric. The other thing is, it's people who are opposed to presumptive parole or to the felony firearms, the change in the felony firearm statute that also came out of committee, which goes to how long we keep people. Opponents to criminal justice reform generally talk about what this will do to victims. It won't do anything to victims. It's a false dichotomy to set victims as an interest against criminal justice reform. Nothing in any of our proposals would prevent a judge from giving a long sentence to somebody who has committed a serious crime. Nothing would require the parole board to release somebody where there's evidence that they're currently a risk. Nothing would affect the rights of victims to present their concerns at sentencing or during the parole process. Nobody has a lock on being concerned about victims. You know, Governor Snyder in his message was very strong on improving services to victims. But at the same time, he endorsed presumptive parole because you can't just keep saying no. You have to look at what the evidence says and what the costs and benefits are of what you're doing.
You've got the governor calling for smart justice and reforming criminal justice. So this report of yours comes at a time when it seems the governor is on the same wavelength. And I'm just wondering, how do you hope that your research and this report from the Citizens Alliance on Prison and Public Spending will help Michigan shift thought processes and correction strategies that seemed appropriate 20 or 30 years ago?
Well, we do things like, you know, talk through the media, which is enormously helpful. We do as much public outreach and public education as we can. We certainly share all our work with legislators and testify whenever bills are up. We work in legislative work groups, as we did, for instance, on the presumptive parole bill, and support other bills. It was Rep. Heisey, the chair of the committee, who actually initiated the felony firearm bill himself, based on a constituent's experience. I don't know if you would remember, but in 78, there were billboards everywhere that said, one with a gun will get you two.
Absolutely.
So anybody who was in possession of a firearm, whether they used it or not, during the course of any felony, didn't have to be a violent felony, would get a mandatory two-year consecutive sentence. Well, now we've got hundreds and hundreds of people in prison only serving that 2 years because they got probation for the underlying felony. Mm. Or they're serving an additional two on top of their time for the underlying felony. And Rep. Heisey's bill would give judges the discretion to sentence for a felony firearm as they do for every other crime. Some of the reforms would save a few hundred beds, some would save a few thousand, but collectively they would add up, we believe, to 10,000 without any of them individually jeopardizing public safety.
Barbara Levine is with the Citizens Alliance on Prisons and Public Spending. You can find the report on their website. It's caps-mi.org. That's caps-mi.org. Barbara, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Cynthia. I appreciated the opportunity to talk with you.